Accession number 20486, Reel 5.
John Young, Reel 5.
Yes, the shorter range intruder operations would be carried out from a Cornish airfield into northern France, and I remember on one occasion I disgusted everybody by bringing my bombs back, because in fact I couldn't find a suitable railway target to which I'd been designated to carry out. But the longer range operations, which were either Operation Mahmoud, that is, going over to Germany with a backward-looking AI to see if we could trap German night fighters by twizzling round quicker than they did, or dropping operators in Czechoslovakia under the guise of reaching out for places like Pilsen. Such operations were carried out not from Fairwood Common, but one went forward to like Castle Camps or Coltishall that had extremely long runways, or Wittering had a very much extended runway, about 4,000 yards. Castle Camps was about 3,000, Coltishall about 3,000. And we took off from there and flew all the way back to Czechoslovakia. And if one had an operator, that is a Secret Service operator, to drop, one simply feathered the starboard propeller, opened the door, and these good people fell out. rather them than me. We had no idea who they were. We were never told. And they were dressed in quite indistinguishable sort of jumpsuits, you might call them today. I think I did two or three of those operations, something like that.
But by intruder operations, I always imagined hanging about round German airfields.
No, that's not. That wasn't the sort of thing this was doing. We were taking people over to Czechoslovakia, to Slovakia, I think, making a nuisance of ourselves over there, at places say like Pilsen or somewhere like that, and then coming back. And landing back at Coltishall or Castle Camps, and then shuttling down to Fairwood Common.
So you were looking for targets of opportunity?
Yes. Well, in a way, we were given a broad idea of what to do. Have a go at the Pilsen. There were steelworks at Pilsen, weren't there, you see? Which were poorly blacked out and things like that. But those were the sort of jobs we were doing, Operation Mahmoud. And then we were also intruding, as I said earlier, one intruder operation was to this Eindhoven place, where I came home, and where West, my flying officer, friend did not.
You were telling me all about Eindhoven before we started to record,
yes.
So perhaps if you could repeat.
Yes, Eindhoven, we found, was not defended by guns, but by incredibly brilliant searchlights, which were focused on the aircraft. Of course, we were coming in quite low, and these incredibly brilliant blue searchlights were focused on us, and indeed, of course, almost certainly brought down West, and his operator, who are now buried at, or remembered at Runnymede. Mm-hmm. I might say that some of these operations are not in my logbook. The reason being that by that time there were limitations placed on the number of operations that squadron commanders and flight commanders could perform. And I obeyed to begin with, and then found myself out of tune with my people in my flight, because obviously I was having to brief them for operations that I had not performed. And what I did was I simply did a few more operations than were in my logbook, because it was a matter of, incredibly, I felt, keeping alive. It was better to be au fait with what was going on than to be safely on one's bottom at Fairwood Common and not knowing the developments. However...
Is Fairwood Common in Suffolk?
In South Wales. Swansea, right? It was right back in Swansea. So we were being positioned forward for these operations. Additionally, of course, Fairwood Common was a night fighter base, but only incidentally. Then suddenly, in November 1943, I found myself posted to the Combined Operations Staff Course in Scotland, which was intensive and amazingly exciting, in that under one of the modules to get through it was to do an assault on a limited width beach under the deterrent of live ammunition. And I remember charging up this beach with the front end of a Bangalore torpedo underneath my right arm, having got out of this landing ship assault. On this beach near the Duke of Argyll's place. And the other end, of course, there was another officer with instructions when I stumbled and fell with the front end of the Bangalore torpedo, and of course kept myself clear. He was to light the blue paper, and he did. It was exceedingly exciting. It gives you an idea of how the poor Pongos lived. Additionally, of course, craft assault on the way into the beach we had had a sergeant with us who said, "Now that's all, gentlemen," and we took off our hats, and there was a crack from the landing ship tank behind us, and a shell went over our heads so close that my hair went choof choof. Anyway, of course, after that little adventure I was no longer allowed to operate over Europe because I had the secrets of the D-Day landing in my head.
You knew it was going to be normal?
Oh, yes, and where and how. The whole thing was discussed in extreme detail. Oh, yes. Cossack and all those people came down and talked to us. But I was... not allowed to operate over Europe, and I was sent to North Africa to command 108 Squadron. I did my best to get there, but I arrived later than they'd pleased them, and I very well remember that on the morning I arrived on a Sunday, by the way, and found myself at a transit camp, where I had to pay to get my knife, fork and spoon in order to have my dinner that night. But to be told when I went to the headquarters in Algiers in the morning, that I was late, that they had appointed Bannum to command 108 Squadron from amongst their own strength, and that I was to be the senior flight commander in 153 Squadron under Janet Gaynor, who in fact would shortly leave and go to the Staff College at Haifa. Of course, this was at Regaia, just east of Algiers, and our duties were to protect the convoys going east and west along the North African coast, and if it was necessary, protect the North African coast. It was only on one occasion, I remember. Yes. On one occasion, we had an intruder, which I estimated was dropping agents in the Constantine area, and in fact they were picked up. And what I did was, with the agreement of the controller in Algiers, I just put a screen of both fighters north of Bougie, at about 60 miles, and one of my people picked him off on the way out. So he went in, dropped his men, crossed the coast, 60 miles an hour, there were four Bow fighters waiting for him. Whichever one he met whopped him, and he did. And then, of course, we were protecting convoys on the North African coast, and the major convoy was due to come, the one with all the ammunition for the major push in the Far East. And we got some warning of this, and it was clear from the activity in the in the day when the convoy had left Gibraltar, from attempted interceptions of the convoy protected by the American Spitfire squadrons based on Oran, that a major attack was planned on this convoy. And with the agreement of the controller at Algiers, I mounted an operation to protect it at night, estimating that the Germans would attack at moonset, which was 4:06 in the morning on the 1st of April, 1944, and indeed they did. I had made my dispositions as squadron commander. The convoy was covered by four radar stations along the North African coast, between Oran and Algiers, and I had put two Bow fighters in each box as the maximum that the COL controller could help, with one in reserve for each section. And I took off from Regaia as the last airplane off, having very carefully made certain before I took off that the Coastal Command airplane, a Ventura of 500 Squadron, had been withdrawn. And I was assured that the withdrawal signal had been sent to him. Well, of course, the Germans attacked exactly at 4:06. Indeed, I advised, arrived in my position after they actually started attacking with, we thought, Dornier 17Hs, but they turned out to be Hunker 177s in later analysis, flying Henschel 293 flying bombs. So this was a very high-tech operation, both in defence and in attack. And there was a general melee in which a number of aircraft went down, and I'm deliberately not saying any more than this for the moment. And towards the end of it, I suddenly picked up visually above me and to support, six blue exhaust flames, and closed. Of course, there was no IFF being transmitted by this aeroplane, and that I checked that with my own operator and with my COL operator. And I followed this aeroplane as it turned away to the north and northeast. He started to go very fast, about 305 or more, towards the northeast, and I sat behind him, really very close, so close indeed that I was sitting on his down starboard quarter. I thought that one of their rear people could see my compass, and so I took my handkerchief out and put it on my compass so they couldn't see it. And I went from one side of this aeroplane to the other, seeing whether he had any resin lights or not. And he hadn't. And after about 10 minutes, and of course, 10 minutes at that speed is 50 miles, sort of thing, you see, it became obvious that this fellow, something had to be done. And I checked all his friendly signs, and they were non-existent, and I'd got other people to check his friendly signs, and other, so I had a control frequency, you see, on the VHF. Other people couldn't see anything, and so I whopped him. And as he went down on fire, of course I saw roundels. And I immediately told the ground that I had shot at an aeroplane and that it was going down in flames, and roundels were clearly visible. I was very upset by this. It was about 60-something miles north of Algiers. I returned to Rigaia, and of course the report had gone forward, and to my astonishment, a message came through Algiers control that Slessor had heard about this business and decreed that I was to be court-martialed. The other flight commander took over, and I was to relinquish command of the squadron and be court-martialed. And the other flight commander, Flight Lieutenant Ward, took over, and he found himself faced with what you might call a mutiny, in that all the rest of the pilots involved, himself and the other 11, refused to put in any combat report. So if you look at the ORB of 153 Squadron, you'll see that it's signed by Ward for that evening, and he later became an Air Marshal, by the way, Air Vice Marshal, and that it says there was an indecisive battle off Cape Tenesh on the North African coast. I was court-martialed under the presidency of Air Chief Marshal Sir John Whitley, who was apparently especially flown out from the a member of the Air Council, who was apparently deliberately flown out to North Africa to conduct the court-martial. And I decided to offer no defence other than the facts. I can't remember, and we have no, astonishingly, we have no record of this court-martial. I'll talk about that in a minute, what the charges were. But at the end of a two-day hearing, I went into the court-martial to hear the verdict, saw the sword across the table, which indicated that I'd been exonerated or found not guilty on all counts.
How would the sword have been placed had you been found guilty?
Ta-dum.
Toward you?
Yes. Yes. And their sword was across the table. And I was... So there, of course, with Ward having... Gaynor having come back from Haifa and handed over back to Gaynor, and myself having been suspended, and I had to be found a job, you see. So I was sent from there to take acting command of 255 Squadron in Italy at Foggia Main, where Geordie Stewart, DSO, was the CO, but had urgent need to go into hospital for his hemorrhoids to be attended to, because I think you probably don't understand that a fighter pilot's life at high G consists of his eyeballs and whatnot going down over his cheeks, but they never say a word about what happens the other end. See? And so...
You mean the piles were caused by his job?
Yes. Oh, yes. Hemorrhoids were quite a common problem in the medical world of fighter pilots. Anyway, Geordie Stewart went off to hospital and then to recuperate because he had a severe problem. And I ran 255 Squadron from late April, you'll see, all in there, until about July the 15th, 1944, when, of course, I was due to finish my third tour. I didn't have an altogether happy time with 255, because I found myself at loggerheads with the bomber commander on Foggia Main, who was losing a very large number of aeroplanes every night, Wellingtons, and I was delegated by Bari, the sector command, to investigate as to possible reasons, and I went all the way up the Danube. With the at about nil feet, you see, I had a radio comparison altimeter. I went all the way up the Danube from the Iron Gate to Budapest, checking for wires across the Danube to see whether the gardening Wellingtons were being snagged, and they were not. There was nothing. So then I went across, pretending to be a Wellington on a particularly busy Wellington night with a full moon, and found that the Wellingtons were all using as a navigation point a series of twizzles on the Drava, a tributary of the Danube, and then proceeding across the Hungarian plain towards Ploiești. See, the German oil field, which was their target. And I carried on from these twizzles on the Drava, and of course I worked out what was really happening, that the Germans had just had a cab rank of Ju-88 night fighters waiting by these twizzles and picking people up, you see. So sure enough, somebody was at about 1,000 meters behind me, in visual to my operator, and I carried on as if I was a bomber. And there, over the Hungarian plain, were green rockets being sent up over the Hungarian plain, marking this bomber stream as it went across. So in addition to their forward-looking radar, the Ju-88s had a visual indicator of the bomber stream. And I waited until I was fairly sure that the description of where the chap was would allow me to do an escape maneuver when I came to one of these areas of dark trees, or towards, so that I was, as it were, between him and the dark trees. And so the next time I came to one of these areas of dark trees, I did with the bowfighter, went straight down almost to ground level underneath this night fighter, and conscious that my duty was to get back with the information. I didn't interfere with him or anything. I just streaked back to Roger Main and reported what was going on. I must admit the group captain was extremely annoyed with me, and the next time I had a bow fighter in trouble and I wanted to land it at Roger Main, he phoned me up, and I said, well, yes, I wanted to land this bow fighter. And he said, I'm young, I'm using my rank, and you are not to do so. So I had to land it somewhere else. So I quickly picked up my telephone and phoned my friend Al. Now, all colonels in the USAF in Italy during the war were called Al, you see. And I phoned Al and said, how about landing one of my bow fighters at Amendola, Al? So he said, sure thing, bud. And my friend was told to divert to Amendola. I quickly sped over towards Amendola. It was only about 20 miles away. And when I got there, of course, the Americans had got all their lights on. They were helping this bow fighter by looking at the undercarriage with a special little searchlight and everything, and in the end, of course, he landed quite successfully, you see, right? So that's the how life was like at Foggia Main. Another feature of life at Foggia Main, of course, was more fundamental and had to do with the introduction of DDT. Now, of course, Foggia Main had been used as a military academy, a military encampment, since the days of Hannibal. And it was, shall I say, alive. When I went to Roger Main, it made life very difficult indeed, you see. But suddenly, this miracle, DDT, was produced, and we dusted it everywhere. And all the little buggles that had been biting us from our bedclothes were killed, and we were able to sleep quite happily during the afternoon. And indeed, how I met Al was that in the middle of our afternoon sleep one day, suddenly there was an enormous row in my encampment, and there, for all to see, was a B-24 in the middle of my tents, you see, on Foggia Main, with people screaming out of the windows that to help them because they'd got severely wounded on board, which we did, you see. But the combination of DDT and a good sleep allowed us to help the crew of this B-24. As a matter of interest, the Americans and Al squadron were doing an extremely brave thing from Foggia. They were flying 12 Liberators over Vienna Neustadt at noon every day at 12,000 feet on an ingoing track of 120. And I said to Al, well, isn't this a little foolhardy? He said, well, bud, you've got to understand that if we keep this up, he did not use Huns, he used the other American word for Germans.
Krauts?
The Krauts, yes. The Krauts will get the idea that they're not going to win. And I thought, you know, how extremely brave that was.